Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And it's Saturday. It's time to go into the vault. Today, we are going to be going back to our first episode on aquatic humanoids from January 23rd, 2018. This was almost exactly a year ago that this first aired. Now, why are we doing so much ocean stuff lately, Robert?
Oh, it's because Transgenesis is coming out. That is a fiction sci-fi podcast. All 10 episodes are going to launch at once so that you can binge them. You can spread them out over your commute, you know, however you want to do it.
Wait, did you even tell them who created Transgenesis?
Oh, well, I created Transgenesis. I wrote and created, worked with Alexander Williams, one of our producers here on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Lauren Vogelbaum was also instrumental in the project. Worked with a number of different outside actors, but also a lot of talent from within the Stuff network, including you, Joe. You were there.
It's right. I make a strange cameo.
So if you want to check that show out, go and subscribe. You should be able to look up Transgenesis, all one word. You can also go to transgenesis.show for more information. But again, this is a science fiction show that deals with the deep ocean. It deals with strange humanoid-like creatures in the deep ocean. But this is why we're going back to these episodes on aquatic humanoids, because they deal with creatures from the deep, creatures of myth and legend, things such as the Tritons, things such as mermaids and other dwellers of the deep.
I think we talk about Creature from the Black Lagoon a good bit.
We do. We do spend a good bit talking about the creature and various gill men. We talk about Lovecraft and Innsmouth. And we may even get into the aquatic ape hypothesis. I'm having trouble remembering.
I think that comes in maybe in part two.
All right.
All right, well, we hope you enjoy this classic episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
First, you will come to the sirens who enchant all who come near them. If anyone unwarily draws in too close and hears the singing of the sirens, his wife and children will never welcome him home again, for they sit in a green field and warble him to death with the sweetness of their song. There is a great heap of dead men's bones lying all around, with the flesh still rotting off them.
Then
They met the things on the little islet with the queer ruins, and it seems them awful pictures of frog fish monsters was supposed to be pictures of these things. Maybe they was the kind of critters as got all the mermaid stories and such started. They had all kinds of cities on the sea bottom, and this island was heaved up from thar.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And if you recognize what those sources were, you probably can tell. We're going to be talking about some mer creatures, some sea folk, something like that today.
That's right. The first was from Homer's The Odyssey, the Samuel Butler translation. The second was from H.P. Lovecraft's The Shadow Over Innsmouth.
Now, there is always an alluring quality to the idea that there's stuff happening down at the bottom of the ocean that has more than just an animal quality, but some kind of intelligence or organizing principle to it. I think of in the George R. R. Martin books, there's this character. Do you remember this guy, Robert, who's like a court jester in Stannis Baratheon's court, who's always singing about what happens under the bottom of the sea?
No, I've forgotten about this.
Well, he like falls in the water at some point and gets rescued. And after that, he's always saying like under the sea. I don't remember what he says, but it's like they have feet, you know, people walk upside down on their hands. And then he always says, I know, ho, ho, ho. And it's kind of mysterious.
Oh, yeah, this does ring a bell now. Well, you know, before we had proper mirrors, the ocean was kind of the looking glass, right? It was kind of the mirror world.
Yeah, so any of those stories where you wonder if there's actually some kind of creature living on the other side of the mirror, if that's another universe we're peering through into, all of that applies to the water as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you think of all the various specimens, the mermaids, the gill men, the sirens. It's fascinating that humans have seemingly always dreamt up humanoids from the deep.
Not just monsters, but humanoids.
Yeah, I mean, because you can certainly expand it and get into the whole realm of sea monsters and various animal-fish hybrids. But there's something particular about those humanoid or partially humanoid creatures, a mirror world beneath the waves and people of some sort that occupy the depths.
Yeah, I mean, even before you had somebody like Giordano Bruno imagining that there could be other planets with surfaces like our planet that could have creatures dwelling on them, you know, when people didn't really have that conception of the sky, you could still definitely wonder about something like that under the ocean. That was like sort of the first outer space. It was the original alien world.
Yeah, indeed. And without a real means of exploring it or understanding it, you were just left with whatever happened to swim up within view, whatever happened to wash up dead and partially rotted away on the shoreline, whatever you were able to pull up with line or net.
Dude, the stuff that washes up dead on the beaches of the Earth is terrifying and crazy now, even though we have like photos and modern science.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine that happening in a world where, you know, the New Jersey beach monster washes up, but it's in the Middle Ages in China or something?
Yeah, it's actually really fascinating to look back, particularly at a lot of the sea monster illustrations on old maps. Mm-hmm. There's a book by Chet Van Duzer, Sea Monsters of Medieval and Renaissance Maps, and he it's filled with wonderful illustrations, but you get to look at all these various creatures, you know, that some fairly realistic you can look at and say, well, that's clearly supposed to be a walrus. That's supposed to be a whale. It just has too many blowholes. And some of them you look at and you realize, well, this is essentially what you might see if you saw the partially decomposed body of a whale, something enormous but a little more beaked looking. Now, in that book, Van Duzer points out that few maps survive from antiquity, but there are map-like mentions and map-like artifacts, such as there's an Assyrian frieze from the palace of King Sargon II, early 8th century BCE, that clearly depicts two Assyrian mermen.
And it's great because if you've ever seen Assyrian reliefs or carvings before, they've all got the same head. You know, mm-hmm. It's all that same guy with the same curly beard and the hat. And these mermaids are like that too.
Yeah. And then you look in other ancient writings. I mean, they're mentioned in Ovid's writing, the Metamorphosis. Ovid lived lived 43 BCE to 17 or 18 CE, and he described the gates of the Palace of the Sun as containing all of these images of mer people. The dark blue sea contains the gods, Melodius Triton, shifting Proteus, Aegean crushing two huge whales together, his arms across their backs, and Doris with her daughters, some seen swimming, some sitting on rocks drying their sea-green hair, some riding the backs of fish. And you can keep going back in time, too. I mean, as Nancy Easterlin pointed out in her 2001 paper, Hans Christian Andersen's Fish Out of Water, the Babylonians recognized gods with fish features or fish hybridity.
Yeah, you can sort of see this as an extension of the way that early creation myths and ancient gods often had water aspects,
yes,
like Tiamat and Abzu, you know, the fresh water and the salt water, or the idea of the creation stories, which almost always involve waters, right? You know,
yeah,
the chaos hover or the being hovering out over the waters.
Yeah, calling back to our Order Out of Chaos episode. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about Enki as well before, the Sumerian water god,
yeah,
which is sometimes described – it's sometimes described as having a cloak of a fish or scaled skin.
Wait, a cloak of a fish or a cloak made out of multiple fish or
– one of the images I saw, it looked like a cloak of little fish icons, like the cloak was made out of fish emoticons.
That's good.
It's pretty great.
That's amazing.
And get this, the ziggurat where people would worship Enki was known as House of the Subterranean Waters.
Hmm. Well, that seems to sort of complete the ziggurat trinity because we've talked about ziggurats before, the ziggurat Etimenanki, which was sometimes believed to be associated with the historical idea of the Tower of Babel. I think that name means something like the house of the foundation of heaven and earth.
Nice. A very regal sounding ziggurat, as if there's another kind of ziggurat.
Right.
Now, additionally, we have
– this is just kind of a humble ziggurat.
Yeah, there's no such thing. If it's going to be a ziggurat, it's going to be a ziggurat.
Yeah.
Now, additionally, we have fish-tailed gods and water dragons found throughout the cultures of India, China, and Japan. And Nancy Easterlin sums up a lot of this nicely. She says, quote, "Some of the mythological sea beings and deities, such as Poseidon and the Sirens, were not originally associated with water and piscine anatomy. The Sirens were originally birds, indicating that divine power and womanly allure became combined with the power and promise of the sea when ancient cultures undertook maritime war and trade." So she argues that that merfolk and mermaids, all these creatures, they're ultimately the descendants, or in her words, the scaled down descendants, which I like because of scales. These are just the scaled down descendants of ancient sea gods.
Yeah, that seems like one example of the principle that displaced gods or fading gods of older theologies often appear in sort of lower status or demoted roles in newer versions of religions.
Yeah, the old trope of the former pagan god becomes a demon in medieval Christian tradition.
Yeah. So obviously we are talking about merfolk, water-dwelling humanoids of various kinds today, and this is going to be the first part of a two-part episode. The first one here, we want to discuss the sort of global merfolk mythology and all of the different ideas of humanoids living in the deep and what that says about us culturally and where these ideas come from. And then in the next episode, we're going to focus more on the science of aquatic humanoids.
Yeah, so this is going to be the mythology and fiction episode, and the next one will be the science and speculative science episode.
Now, Robert, one of the first ones you mentioned was the Sirens.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we had the reading from the Odyssey at the start of the episode that refers to them. But one thing you'll notice is that there was no description of the Sirens.
Yeah. What do they look like?
Well, we don't know because Homer never actually describes them. They were later described, though, as being half bird, much like the harpy.
Hmm.
And later periods of development merged them with the northern mermaid in Christian Europe. But medieval bestiaries stuck to the bird hybridity, though, up through at least 1220. And then you had this gentleman, Isidore of Seville, who lived 560 through 636 CE, and he attributed them with scales and webbed feet and sometimes tails and wings as well. But from the Middle Ages onward, that's where the Sirens really took on the mermaid look, and it stuck.
I'm trying to think of depictions of them I've seen in movies, but I don't think I have. The only thing that comes to mind is, "Oh, brother, where art thou?" But in that, they're not hybrids. They're just humans that are – but they are in a creek bed.
That's right. right. I feel like a lot of the depictions that, I'm accustomed to, mainly through the I had the Time Life book series of myths and monsters or myths and legends.
Okay.
And there were some siren images in there, and a lot of them were just basically beautiful women out on rocks, mm-hmm. luring the wide-eyed Greek sailors to their doom.
Now, of course, if you're not familiar with the story, it's that the sirens would sing, right?
Right.
And that their singing was so lovely that it would drive men mad, and they would want to come ashore to meet the sirens, I guess, or be drawn to the singing, but instead their vessels would be dashed upon the rocks.
Right. Yeah, and in various accounts of the sirens, they vary. Like, maybe you'd starve to death, or perhaps you'd drown. I guess the basic underlying reality of the myth is the ocean is a dangerous place.
Right.
And if you go out upon the ocean, you might meet your doom.
I always thought that what Odysseus does in the story of his encounter with the sirens was an interesting sort of metaphor for the ways some people experiment with mind-altering substances, mm-hmm. which is that he has his men lash him to the ship's mast so that he can't control, you know, he can't drive the ship into the rocks, but all the other men plug their ears and he wants to hear it.
They are all the designated drivers.
Yes.
Though in a sense he's the designated driver because he is the only one who can tell them when they're out of the siren's range.
Right.
But yeah, they're all plugged up. He's the one that's roped to the mast, mm-hmm. begging to be let free, and they're under strict orders that the more I beg, the more you need to rope me to the mast.
Right.
Now another interesting individual or race, depending on how you look at it, from Greek mythology, the Triton. So
okay.
Triton was originally a specific mer person.
It's Ariel's father, right?
Was that his name in the cartoon?
In the Disney movie, oh, okay. Wasn't it? I thought you just saw a Little Mermaid-themed show in Florida, didn't you?
I did, but it was at WikiWachi, which is the long-running mermaid show there, and the underwater dancing is a very limited storytelling medium, and I don't think her father ever showed up in it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think that's his name. I remember this from childhood. The guy with the big beard and the trident.
Okay.
The merman king. He's King Triton.
Oh, okay. I definitely remember him, but I didn't remember his name. Well, the Tritons eventually became seen as just a class of merpeople in Greek myth. They were the sons of Poseidon and Amphitrite. They had humanoid bodies covered in scales, and then they had dolphin tails. Matted green or yellow hair. They had gills as well as pointed kind of elf ears. Wide mouths, fangs, and they typically would serve as escorts for the Nereid sea nymphs as well as general attendants for sea divinity.
Mm.
And our old friend Hesiod said that they inhabited golden palaces under the sea.
Now, sounds like King Triton.
Yeah, exactly. This is key to so many of our myths and legends of merpeople.
Now, I'm wondering, this is kind of interesting that it's combining features of the House of Ichthos, right? It's got the scales mm-hmm. and the fish-like characteristics, but then they've also got dolphin tails. So there's this melding of aquatic mammals and fish.
Well, of course, you have to remember that for the longest time, this was not a clear distinction, the idea that dolphins were not fish.
Right.
So, you know, it makes sense that you would just mesh it all up under miscellaneous sea beasts. Oh, and also in medieval times, Tritons were made the male counterparts of sirens.
The male counterparts as in like they were the same species or like they were just friends or what?
My understanding is that it's like they were of the same species, if one dares to get too technical with your mythological peoples under the waves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this will be very interesting later on when we discuss modern treatments of mermaids and fish people.
Okay, so fangs, scales, dolphin tails, humanoid characteristics, that's not enough hybridity for me. I want you to mash in some more stuff.
Well, you're in luck, Joe, because there's another creature to consider here, the ichthyocentaur.
So good.
Yes. So you had something called a centaurotriton, which was basically what occurs when you have a triton that's depicted with like a definite dolphin-esque hindquarters
okay.
region. But then the ichthyocentaur takes the hybridity to a whole nother level. So we see this in around the 3rd century Common Era, and this is found in the natural history text Physiologists. And this creature, the ichthyocentaur, was said to have the torso and head of a man,
okay.
the four legs of a horse or lion,
all right.
the hindquarters of a dolphin,
mm-hmm.
and unlike the centaurotriton, they had scales.
Now, I'm so imagining what kind of habitat this creature dwells in. When would it be useful to have the four legs of a horse and the tail of a dolphin?
Well, I mean, you could really tease that apart and get into, I guess, the symbolic meaning of the things. Uh-huh. Or you end up coming back to your idea of, like, here's something washed up on the beach. Make sense of it. And, well, this is kind of the story that ends up spreading about it. There are no classical accounts of the ichthyocentaur, according to the resources I was looking at, but mm-hmm. they remained a decorative motif. Which is kind of the ultimate fate of a lot of these, like the mermaid and the triton and the ichthyocentaur. They become just part of medieval iconography going forward, and they come to symbolize other things. The mermaid, in particular, becoming to symbolize just sort of the evil and monstrous nature of the female. Sometimes depicted, I believe, with a fish to show that she is entrapping the Christian soul.
Yeah, I often think of the tradition of the mermaid as being one of temptation, mm-hmm. like that it establishes kind of like a foolish and weak-willed sailor that will give in to the temptation of the mermaid because he has not properly disciplined his spirit to resist sin.
It reminds me a lot of the incubi and succubi legends we've discussed in the podcast before, where the feet would be a giveaway. The feet would be the feet of a beast. And therefore, any rational believer would notice the feet of the creature and cease to pursue this foolish pairing. But
yeah, that's an interesting parallel. Like they both go back to this idea of the sinner as someone who's oblivious to difference.
Yeah, like they can't see all the warning signs here. The main warning sign, of course, being that the individual is part fish.
All right, well, maybe we should take a quick break, and then when we come back, we will discuss more aquatic humanoid legends from around the world.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So not every person in mythology and legend is a villain. Sometimes you see some that that have beneficial aspects as well. There's, for instance, the Ninyo of Japanese legend. This is essentially less of a mermaid and more of just a fish with a beautiful woman's face.
Okay.
And it's protective and warns of misfortune on land and sea. And then there's also an interesting one from the Mi'kmaq people of eastern Canada. They're known as the halfway people, these particular merfolk. They had the upper bodies of a body of a human and the lower body of a fish, and they'd warn fishermen of coming storms or invoke storms if they were disrespected.
Now, I have to add another North American or Canadian entry, less folkloric and more of a one-off, but I'm adding it because I've seen this in person. Mm-hmm. Robert, the Banff Merman. You've looked up images, right?
I did. I was not familiar with this one. I'd of course, heard of the Fiji Mermaid, and I've never been to Banff, but I'm familiar with it. You know, you've talked about your adventures there, and it does not seem like a likely mermaid destination.
No, not really. I mean, so this is inland Canada. This is in Alberta in Banff National Park. So this is a mountainous region, not a coastal region, but it has lakes. And so in these lakes, I guess one might expect to find some kind of hybrid humanoid aquatic creature. And so inside this business in Banff in Alberta, there is a little store called the Indian Trading Company. And in the back of the store, there is a taxidermied creature that's half fish, half humanoid gremlin. And it looks like, I don't know, how would you describe it? Like the back of it just looks straight up like a fish. It's a fish with the head cut off. Mm-hmm. And then that fish just goes straight into some ribs with like human baby arms, but with claws on them and a scary looking head that has hair.
Yes. I mean, it looks like a taxidermied creation. I mean, that is what it is. It is a fish and probably some sort of a small monkey that the remains of which were sewn together.
Yeah. Or I think it's also possible that the top half of it could just be artificial. Could be a crafted artifact. According to a write-up on Atlas Obscura, it was probably bought by a man named Norman Luxton, who was the proprietor of the shop around 1915 when it first showed up there. It's very much in the traditional of like the P.T. Barnum kind of thing, the Fiji mermaid.
Yeah, so some kind of a sideshow oddity sort of thing.
Yeah, except it stays right here in this in this store. I don't know how long it's been totally stationary there. But yeah, if you go to Banff and you go to the store and you go into the back room, you'll see lots of oddities. There is like a giant taxidermied bear, I think, and some moose heads and other local stuff. But yeah, this thing's in a glass case. It's got a mirror behind it. And they sell postcards.
Ah.
It's like I saw the Banff Merman.
Interesting. Well, I've got to check that out when I finally get up to Banff. Now, speaking of Canadian, we can sort of extend that and think of French traditions as well. Mm-hmm. There is a mermaid in French traditions known as Melusine. And much like Echidna, the mother of monsters in Greek myth, mm-hmm. the French mermaid here boasts a two-pronged tail.
Oh, you know what that reminds me of?
Ah.
Dagon.
Well, yeah, I thought you were going to say Starbucks. But yes, also the movie, the Stuart Gordon movie Dagon that came out in 2001.
It's kind of a mixed bag. Not a great movie, but there's some things to like about it.
Yeah, it's a Lovecraftian, like it's basically an adaptation of Shadow over Innsmouth. Mm-hmm. But they lean into the mermaids a little more. They lean into the sex and violence a little more. It's worth checking out if you like violent fish people movies.
Yeah. But what about Starbucks?
Starbucks? Well, just coffee, basically. But that logo with the mermaid with the two-pronged tail going up on each side of the creature, like that's basically Melusine or Echidna, depending on how you want to look at it.
Robert, I hate to say it, but I don't think anybody ever pays attention to that logo unless they're trying to get mad about it, her not having a Santa hat or something.
It would be interesting if people started getting mad over that. It's like, why does this mermaid have two tails instead of one?
Right.
We want an American mermaid, not a French mermaid.
Right, one tail. One country, one tale.
Well, they're probably, pining for the classic mermaid, the havfru, the Danish mermaid.
Why is this the classic?
Well, you know, because when you really think about mermaids, you think of like Hans Christian Andersen, you think of Northern Europe.
Oh, so to be clear, Hans Christian Andersen is the author of the Little Mermaid story.
Yes, yeah.
That the Disney movie is loosely based on, very loosely, because mm-hmm. in his version, there's a lot more like blood and cutting off feet and stuff.
Oh, yes. It's a bit more violent. But over in Denmark, they did have the havfru, and this is a pretty helpful mermaid because it can also tell the future, and it allegedly foretold the birth of Danish King Christian IV of Denmark. So that's a beneficial mermaid for you.
Okay.
And of course, I have to mention the monkfish. Are you familiar with the monkfish, or perhaps its kin, the bishop fish?
Well, I know of the monkfish like the monkfish, but you're not thinking of like the monkfish that you would eat, right?
This is this was a creature, widely reported marine creature in northern European waters, described in Ambrose Paré's 16th century work on monsters. It had the head of a human, the tonsured hairstyle of a monk, a monk's cowl and cape, and two extremely long flippers. It's a ridiculous looking creature. It looks like you drew a monk as a fish. It's
I know
cartoony,
what you're talking about now.
As it sounds.
I've seen the medieval drawings. Yeah,
but the cool thing is that there's a very strong case to be made that these were based on descriptions of dead giant squid, because you have this kind of thick, lumpy body that kind of tapers off on one end and then has a number of tentacles and then two very long additional arms that would have been the two extremely long flippers of the monkfish.
Yeah, I'm looking at the comparisons right now. I can see why that would have been the case.
And there was also a Chinese variant of this, the Hai Ho Sheng, which was the sea Buddhist priest. So, again, we're getting back to the idea of when you're talking about a mythical sea creature, there are a number of different ways to look at it. You know, is it a former god that's been demoted? Is it a dead sea animal that someone has misinterpreted and then someone else has heard about that? And then that person told another individual who illustrated it and wrote it in a medieval bestiary. These are just a few of the possible excuses for many of these fantastic creatures.
So is there anything that seems to unite all of the legends we've looked at so far? Or are aquatic humanoids as diverse as real humans? Or as diverse as other gods and monsters?
Well, there's always the sense of the familiar yet alien.
Yeah. And the sense that it's lots of monsters are familiar yet alien, but that they come from another world, the aquatic humanoids do.
Yes, they are familiar yet foreign. They are something. They're people from the other side of the mirror.
Yeah, I've got another one. Maybe let me know what you think about this. When I think of ocean dwelling humanoids in mythology and fiction, they don't usually seem to be like party hard kind of gods or party hard monsters or humanoids. They usually seem kind of sad.
Yeah.
There's a kind of melancholy that we associate with the underwater life and the ocean that may come from the sad faces of fish. I don't know if that's too crazy of a stretch. When I look at fish faces, I tend to project emotions on them, and those emotions are never like happiness. Fish faces always look a little bit sad, like they're disappointed in something, like they wish things were going better.
Well, it comes back to the old saying, a fish out of water as well, right? There's nothing more awkward than a creature that has been taken from its natural habitat and thrown into another. The fish out of water is a thing that is vulnerable, perhaps doomed.
Mm-hmm.
It is in shock. And therefore, I think we do see that a lot with our merfolk of various designs in our myths and our fictions.
Yeah, sad fish faces, and also kind of a shadowy realm, right? The
mm-hmm.
the underwater world for these underwater humanoids is another world, but it's the world that the sun is on the opposite side of the barrier from. Like,
yeah.
The sun is all ours, and the sun they get is just what filters down through the membrane of the water surface.
Yeah, but then sometimes there are depictions, again, the golden cities of the Tritons.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
So there is a sense of the glorious, but also this sense of just sort of alien hard work as well. Like,
uh-huh.
I mean, maybe I'm projecting more about, you know, what we know from covering aquatic biology and just the aquatic habitat, knowing that it is such a place of intense competition.
You know, when I think of the ultimate melancholy underwater humanoids, I got to go to the Universal Monster movies. It's the Gill Man.
Yeah, the Gill Man. I mean, I imagine most of the people listening to this podcast grew up with the Gill Man.
Right. Creature from the Black Lagoon, 1954.
Yeah.
Part of the classic Universal monster movie canon, except the Gill Man was different from a lot of the others in that, unlike Dracula or Frankenstein, which had been the subject of novels of horror and science fiction at the time, the Gill Man was, though a synthesis of many of these human merfolk kind of traditions, was not from like a novel that existed.
Right. It's and there are other interesting facts about it too. Like, for instance, unlike Frankenstein or Dracula or the Mummy, the Gill Man was a product of the natural world.
Yeah.
It was just a product of the natural world that no longer had a place in the modern world.
And that's why it often gets classed as a science fiction movie instead of a horror movie.
Yeah, though the science discusses is rather sketchy.
Oh, the science is even better in the sequel, Revenge of the Creature. We should get to that in a few minutes.
Yeah, I grew up with this monster, like I'm sure you did. I remember mm-hmm. having that. I had the little glow-in-the-dark figurine of it as a kid. I had these Universal trading cards that had been my dad's that had all these Universal monsters and some horrible jokes on them.
You people at home, Robert has brought these cards in. I think we should read a couple of the jokes on the back of them.
Oh, okay. You go for it, Joe. I'll play along.
Okay. Joke on the first one. So the first one shows the Gill Man on the front. It mm-hmm. said, "Did you say fish for dinner? Anyone I know? Yuck, yuck,
he's
yuck.
A fish."
And then on the back, it's got this. "First ghost, colon, we just had a baby. Second ghost, colon, congratulations. Was it a ghoul or a boy?"
See, that's some straight up Crypt Keeper humor right there. That's pretty good.
I got an even better one. So the front is the creature, but it's from the third movie, The Creature Walks Among Us, mm-hmm. when he sort of gets turned into a regular human. And the back has a joke that says, "What's a cowardly skeleton?"
I don't know, Joe. What's a cowardly skeleton?
A boned chicken.
Hmm. See, I
boned
think that,
chicken.
That's probably a joke that we would get if this were the early 1960s, but I do not get it.
Boned chicken. Oh, man, there's this whole world of butchery jokes that we just don't have access to.
But it's great, you know, because this is a joke that no longer fits into our time. And that's basically the idea of the creature. And I think one of the it's telling that the creature continues to be celebrated despite the fact that there has not really been a Creature from the Black Lagoon movie since the original trilogy, but he's taken on this sort of outsider icon status.
Yeah, I'm really mortified for the time when they come in to remake Creature from the Black Lagoon. I don't want it. I don't think we're ready.
Yeah, really, I mean, Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water which just came out at Christmas, that's really the best possible Creature from the Black Lagoon remake, even though it is not officially Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Right. No, I'm talking about like the Tom Cruise Mummy universe remakes where it would be like, Benedict Cumberbatch as the Gill Man, and then...
He'd make a good Gill Man.
Who would play the Lugs who show up in the lagoon and start poking him with stuff?
Oh, I don't know. Just you can just... point a scatter gun at an IMDb page, I guess. You'll get some candidates.
So when did you first see the Gill Man on screen?
I think before I saw any of the movies, I was introduced to it in 1982's It Came from Hollywood.
Ah, that's a great one.
Yeah, it's basically just a bunch of old movie trailers stitched together with some at times delightful jokes, at times cringeworthy jokes, and various celebrity guest spots from like Cheech and Chong, Dan Aykroyd, John Candy. They were principals on this project.
Mm-hmm. They highlight great brain attack scenes.
Yes. Yeah, there's a whole section on guerrilla movies. It's a wonderful film. It's hard to find these days because I think some of the rights issues prevent it from being properly distributed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you don't see the Gill Man showing up in repeated uses throughout other films the same way you do like Bela Lugosi's version of Dracula or the Frankenstein monster.
Exactly. Now, one of the things though about the Gill Man, to bring it back to some of these themes we're discussing here though, is that outsider aspect, the idea that there's something sympathetic and yet other, or depending on how you're looking at it, threatening and yet other. And when you start teasing the Gill Man apart, there are some really unsettling dimensions to the creature.
Mm-hmm.
The same can certainly be said of H.P. Lovecraft's 1936 story, The Shadow over Innsmouth, which, of course, was published before the creature came to our cinemas, and is kind of a proto-creature short story.
Mm-hmm. It's got aquatic humanoids, right?
It does. It has a whole race of aquatic humanoids that end up interbreeding with this rural fishing and trade community, and that is like the horror of the piece. It's the idea that there are fish people and humans are breeding with them. And, you know, I first read this as a 1936 story. I read it in 96 for the first time. And I remember being like really just blown over by it. I thought it was just such a creepy atmospheric tale.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little more disturbing the more one reads about it and the more one knows about Lovecraft and his sentiments towards other peoples and other races.
Yeah, Lovecraft was very imaginative, but he was not a nice person.
No. Sometimes excuses are made for him. This is a guy that lived 1890 through 1937, and some people defend him by saying, he was a product of his time, as we all are. But he was definitely a man with some very problematic views on race, especially for modern readers.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, even if we're to leave out his personal letters and so forth, his fiction often falls back on the trend of championing a white English culture over everything else. And we see the other races sometimes depicted as just outright monstrous.
You often get the sense for him that any non-Anglo ethnic groups are sort of allied with the monsters.
Yeah, there's something like threatening and debilitative about them in his work. There's a lot to unpack in Innsmouth, and again, in many ways, it is a tremendous short story. It was highly influential, but as Evan Lampe discusses in his paper in praise of the Innsmouth look, Nautical Terror and the Specter of Atlantic History in H.P. Lovecraft's Fiction, you can compare it to Lovecraft's earlier story, The Dunwich Horror, which presents a town with a, quote, degraded population of ignorant, backward, physically stunted villagers. This, again, encapsulating his Lovecraft's anxieties concerning not only other races, but even just like other like classes of people within the United States. But Lampe points out that, quote, the fall of Dunwich is a result of racial decline brought on by isolation, which is a source of terror in the narrative. But in Innsmouth, it's not isolation but contact with distant lands via Atlantic commerce that serves as their undoing. So Lampe says, quote, Innsmouth's degradation is a result of its worldliness, not its isolation. Even if the city became a backwater, it looked out to the Atlantic for much of its history, open to the world, its ideas, and its people.
So in some ways, the creatures from the sea here are standing in for – contact and intercourse with other cultures, right?
Yeah.
And that sort of works for the sea because the sea is traditionally like a way for cultures to come together. It's the, you know, the trade routes are through the sea.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then that's what makes the story so icky if you read it with all this in mind is that it's a tale that's describing the adoption of other cultures and certainly with the interbreeding with other cultures as being something that is inherently monstrous, that white Anglo-Saxon people should not venture out either, you know, mentally or certainly physically or sexually.
Yeah, this is a really troubling strain in Lovecraft's work, especially since Lovecraft is so popular with so many people today, like for his monsters and mm-hmm. his settings and stuff. I feel like this is sort of like the part of him that nobody really wants to think about.
Yeah, I mean, it can be difficult because like I say, I grew up loving Lovecraft's work and I still have a strong affinity for the Lovecraftian vibe, you know, mm-hmm. for that weird fiction world and many of the older writers from the day. But I mean, you can't stick your head in the sand regarding the sensibilities that are not only present in the individual behind the stories, but in the works themselves.
Yeah. And so we got here from Creature from the Black Lagoon. I'm wondering if this is leading to you thinking that some of the same themes can be ported over to Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Well, you know, I didn't used to think so. I used to think that the Creature from the Black Lagoon was somehow separate from any real world concerns. You know, it's kind of this. I mean, it's rated G for goodness sake, the first one anyway. Maybe the other two as well. But I distinctly remember seeing the G rating on the first film. It's essentially a Disney movie,
yeah,
just with a murderous monster in it. Well, but before we get into any racial aspects of the Creature from the Black Lagoon, we should probably just take a moment to enjoy the existence of the film on its own merits.
Quote from Q magazine about Creature from the Black Lagoon. This horrendous pseudo-science fiction melodrama revolves wildly in three dimensions and with considerable excitement around a poor ancestral fish that never quite made the grade to man.
All right. Well, that's pretty accurate, I guess. I mean, it's often looked at as one of the lesser of the Universal movies, though even though the monster itself is pretty great.
Yeah. It might be the best Universal monster in terms of makeup and stuff. Well, I mean, that's debatable, I guess.
It certainly is more ambitious makeup-wise than—
I mean, Karloff's Frankenstein is a pretty amazing makeup creation.
It's true. But does Frankenstein begin with the Big Bang?
No, it doesn't. And Creature from the Black Lagoon sure does. It starts with a big explosion. It's sort mm-hmm. of the inverse of Bride of the Monster. Starts with a big explosion. And their idea of what the Big Bang is that it involved literally exploding chunks of rock.
Yes. Yeah. It looks like a mining detonation. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and they get into this whole narrative about how the creature is a product of the Devonian period from 60 million years ago.
Okay. You know, it's pretty old.
The age of the trilobites.
Yeah. You know? It's when they went extinct, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course you get the Dunkleosteus back then.
That's right. And then they spend a lot of time talking about the lungfish. They sort of throw a lot of science at the screen early on to try and trick you into thinking that this is a scientifically accurate picture.
Now, it was released in 3D. Did you ever see it in 3D, Robert?
I never did, but that's right. They filmed the first two of these films in 3D.
But a lot of people, even when it very first came out, saw it flat because it was at the very end of the early 50s 3D craze that it was released, so it was already becoming passé. I actually rewatched this movie last night. If you ever get a chance to check out the Universal Monster movies set, the remaster of Creature, it's got a great commentary track by horror mm-hmm. scholar Tom Weaver. And I just wanted to mention a few things I learned from it, some really interesting highlights. One of them was, where did this story come from? Like, what is the origin of the creature? So the producer of Creature from the Black Lagoon was this guy named William Alland, who was the producer of the film. He was a Universal producer at the time, and he made his start as an actor working with Orson Welles in the Orson Welles Theater Group. He was part of the infamous War of the Worlds radio broadcast.
Ah, yes.
But he was also friends with Welles. And so sometime in the 1940s, during the filming of Citizen Kane, Alland was an actor in Citizen Kane as well. He was the reporter who was hunting down the meaning of the word rosebud. And so Allend was over at Wells' house for a dinner party. Also in attendance was Dolores Del Rio, who was a Mexican actress who was Orson Welles' partner at the time, and a Mexican cinematographer named Gabriel Figueroa, who would go on to a really stellar career. He was the cinematographer of things like The Pearl and John Huston's Night of the Iguana. And during this dinner party, the story goes, Figueroa starts in on this bizarre story about a half-man, half-fish creature that lived in the Amazon River near a certain village. And according to Figueroa's telling, once a year, the fish man would come up out of the river and claim one maiden from the village as its victim, and then it would retreat into the water, and the village would be safe again until it emerged the next year. Apparently, at first, the other guests thought Figueroa was kidding, but he insisted, and he started getting worked up because he wasn't being taken seriously, and he claimed the story was absolutely true and that he'd seen a photo of the Amazon fishman.
Oh, wow.
So this was early 40s, and despite how awkward of a dinner it must have been, apparently the story must have stuck in the deep inside the mind of William Allend. And about 10 years later, when he was a producer at Universal, he decided to make a version of the Amazon fishman story into a new entry in the Universal monster movie canon. So he wrote up this three-page treatment of the film, which was supposed to start not with the Big Bang, but with a reenactment of his dinner conversation with Figueroa.
Oh, wow.
Followed by an expedition to the Amazon with a fishman creature. And, of course, he wanted to have a gorgeous blonde that would get kidnapped by the fishman. And then the rest of the story was basically just a ripoff of the plot of King Kong, but with a fish man instead of a giant ape. So they'd capture him, bring him back to civilization, he'd escape and, you know, run amok in the cities.
And that's basically the territory they explore in the three creature movies.
Yeah, if you put together the first Creature from the Black Lagoon and the second movie, Revenge of the Creature, that came out in 1955, the following year, together they are the plot of King Kong.
Yeah. Now, one of the other things I love about The Creature from the Black Lagoon is that you had – this is a product of Florida.
Oh, and, yeah.
And I've now been to some of these locations in Florida that are tied to it, such as Wakulla Springs, which I mentioned on the show before, a fabulous destination.
That's where they shot a lot of the underwater stuff.
Or
I think maybe all of the underwater stuff.
Well, if memory serves, they certainly did all of the underwater stuff in the third movie there. I'm not as sure about the first one because there are a number of different spring locations that are used in some of these films. And then they're tied into other like weird Florida places like the Wikiwachi Mermaid Show. Julie Adams' stunt double from the first film was a mermaid swimmer at the Wikiwachi Mermaid Show.
Oh, yeah. That's a great fact about the movie is that anytime you see the characters above water, they're played by different actors than the people who played them below water. So like the Gill Man above water was one actor they had in Hollywood. And then below the water, the Gill Man was always this other guy, Rico Browning.
Yes. Yeah. A fascinating figure who's also come up on the podcast before because he worked briefly with John C. Lilly. But
crazy.
Yeah, there's a crazy story there. Go back and listen to that episode if you want the details on that. But he was also tied to Wikiwachi and really had quite a career outside of The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, did you know that Rico Browning directed the underwater scenes that go on for 37 hours in Thunderball?
I read that the other day, but I wasn't aware of it previously, no.
Oh, my God. When was the last time you saw Thunderball?
I was a child watching it on TBS.
Okay. Yeah, it's one of those Sean Connery Bonds. So it has parts that are kind of fun, but the underwater fight scenes are just interminable. Go on forever. But I'm sure they're very well choreographed, especially for the time. I mean, shooting underwater back in the 50s and 60s was not easy.
Yeah, I mean, if you accept them on their own terms, they're kind of marvelous. It's just they don't necessarily match up to modern cinematic pacing standards, I guess.
Another thing that's kind of interesting to me about The Creature from the Black Lagoon that Weaver mentions in his commentary is that Creature has a lot of monster's eye view shots. And this is contrasted to some of the earlier Universal monster movies and some of the other movies that Allend and Jack Arnold had done. I'm not sure if that says anything interesting about how they thought of the creature, but there is a lot in how the story was created and in how it's filmed that does, to me, make the creature kind of a sad, melancholy, sympathetic sort of character, unlike, say, Dracula, who is a predatory demon who
right.
arrives to, you know, to consume people's souls and kill them and turn them into his servants. The creature from the Black Lagoon is a sad creature who never really – I mean, like, he lives in the Black Lagoon.
Mm-hmm.
People come and invade his territory, and then they start messing with him and attacking him, and he fights back. Now, of course, he does try to kidnap Julie Adams, the leading lady in the movie, presumably because he's wowed by her beauty, and so it's a King Kong kind of thing.
Right.
He falls in love and wants to carry her off to his cave. But you often get the sense in the Creature from the Black Lagoon movies that the real villains are like the human heroes.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think this is something I picked up on as a kid, especially the more I learned about and ultimately when I saw the third film, The Creature Walks Among Us, because mm-hmm. in this one, they've captured the creature, horribly burned it in the process,
mm-hmm.
and then they treat the creature, and there's this hokey scientific explanation, basically Lamarckian evolution, where the creature's scales fall away and it has human flesh underneath and it's becoming more man-like. And there are all these just sad scenes of this now land creature standing in this little enclosed area surrounded by barbed wire, longing for the sea. But it can't even go back to the sea because it will drown if it does.
Yeah.
And in all these films, it's like especially the white leads in the film, like they're never really in peril. Like they're always in control. The creature just lumbers about. And the only reason it's able to grab the lady is because she just stands there and screams instead
right.
of like walking away from it.
Right. Yeah, generally the human lead characters in these films are just not very sympathetic. They're usually just coming into this monster's domain or not. I mean, it's a creature. They're coming into the creature's domain,
mm-hmm.
and they're in the second movie. They fish for the creature with dynamite. They throw dynamite in the
yeah.
Black Lagoon. It blows him up, and he floats to the surface stunned. And then they take him and they put him in a tank at SeaWorld and chain him to the bottom. And there's a great scene where somebody goes, "I hope that chain holds." And the other guy goes, "I wouldn't worry about that chain." So you see him like suffering and struggling and pulling at his chain, and eventually he gets free and then runs around. And yet again, it's like the heroes of the movie are the real villains.
It reminds me a lot of the late great Gil Scott-Heron had a bit, kind of a stand-up bit, like a spoken word bit that he did, talking about Jaws. And he was saying like, why are you upset about Jaws attacking people? You're going where Jaws is.
Mm-hmm.
Like you should only be upset if Jaws is attacking people in the city where you are. Like you've gone where you're not supposed to be. So of course there's Jaws.
All right. I think we need to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we will discuss more about aquatic humanoid legends and the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Trek all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
All right, we're back. All right, so I mentioned earlier that I used to think of the creature as being this mostly pure thing that was untouched by the concerns of the real world.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was turned on to the commentary of Robin R. Means Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, there was an episode of the NPR podcast Code Switch,
mm-hmm,
about the movie Get Out. And they talked about some of the history of African Americans in horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up looking up Coleman's book. It's titled Horror Noir, Blacks in American Horror Film from the 1890s to the Present. And she shares the following read on the creature. Quote, "The Gill Man is Kong and Gus from The Birth of a Nation rolled into one impossible body. Bodily, the monster resembled a racist caricature. Its lips are large and exaggerated. Its skin is dark. It is seemingly feeble-minded. Its movements are shambling except for a swift, adept move it displays when stealing away with a white woman."
Oh, that's rough.
Yeah, and side note, if anyone's not familiar, Gus, who she mentions here, is the antagonist from the 1915 movie The Birth of a Nation, the film attributed to the revival of the Ku Klux Klan terrorist organization in the United States. In it, the Klan serve as heroes as they lynch an African American named Gus, portrayed by a white actor in blackface who chases a white woman off of a bridge. Coleman refers to this as the first real racial horror movie.
Hmm.
And as Coleman points out, the creature from the Black Lagoon, the film features a white female researcher who is only there to scream and serve as the object of desire.
Yep.
A team of local Brazilians who only serve to perish in the first portion of the film.
Yeah.
Only the white scientific elite are able to best the creature. And certainly best it they do. These guys are supposed to be scientists, but instead of studying it, they just destroy it for the crime of making eyes at this white woman.
Yeah, again, it's what we've been saying. I mean, they just show up in its lagoon and then they start attacking it essentially. And we're supposed to feel bad for them.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, there's always this ambiguity in the monster movies of old, like King Kong, Creature from the Black Lagoon, where you get the sense that maybe you're supposed to feel some sympathy for the creature. It's not quite clear how much.
Yeah. And then, I mean, this additional racial read on everything just makes everything all the more problematic.
Yeah.
She argues that the film presents a world in which
the white race alone has evolved and the rest are static.
Hmm.
She points to the work of Patrick Gonder, who argues that the film isn't just about reinforcing white superiority and non-white inferiority. It's a film that taps into racist fears of desegregation. Quote, as the black monster in leaving its proper place in the water and attempting to integrate among those on land is a Darwinian reminder of why segregation is necessary. So, and I would argue that this is all the more unsettling if you go into the third creature movie and watch it with these scenes of this even more human-looking creature, like just behind barbed wire, just trapped, treated like an animal, even as you have these two characters that are engaging in these monologues about it's the jungle versus the stars, about how we need to be kinder to the creature instead of violent towards it. It's a very flawed and mishandled film, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting how this read, this racial read of the creature, which some of you might not care for, but I think on one hand it meshes with what was going on in The Shadow of Rinsmith. I think it also echoes a lot of these ideas that we've already discussed of the aquatic humanoid as being this other, this creature that, I mean, think to the Triton and the Siren. Like the Siren is beautiful and desirable. The Triton, though the masculine version, is to be feared, is more brutal. And that lines up with various racist depictions in which the female of another race is an exotic object of desire, and then the male counterpart is depicted as something brutish. I'm not trying to ruin a classic film for anybody, but I do think this read is really worth considering when you start thinking about the era that the film came from, mm-hmm. and the attitudes of the time, and what that the film is supposed to say to a modern viewer.
Yeah, I think that is a totally valid interpretive lens. I don't know of any evidence that this is what the filmmakers consciously had in mind. I think it's
right.
Probably not, but that you can certainly see how these sorts of themes come out from the unconscious forces that guide our creativity.
Right. Very much so. So as we begin to close out this episode, let's return to just some of the trends that we've identified skirted around concerning the various myths and fictions of aquatic humanoids. Like what do they represent? What do they convey?
Obviously the mirror world.
That's right, yeah. The unknown depths as well as the dangers of the sea.
Mm-hmm. The feature we so often see in legends of monsters, which is hybridity,
right.
Bringing together different features of different animals and humans.
Yeah, and just mysterious biology as well. Animals, again, washing up on the beach, and also humans with birth defects such as Sirenomalia. Which is a birth defect that involves the fusing of the legs together.
Mm.
It's a really depressing topic, but I have read a couple of papers making the argument that some mermaid legends might be based on these defects. Also, we've mentioned mermaids as harbingers of doom, as well as sources of divine aid. There's the idea that it's the erotic other, it's the monstrous other, the evil or monstrous feminine, and just the idea too that it can be depicted as a racial other that does not belong in our world.
It's amazing that water has so much power to carry so much symbolic weight and to project so many different symbolic meanings. Like I'm thinking about the way it's this mirror world in The Creature from the Black Lagoon, but then also the way in Shadow Over Innsmouth it can represent the idea of commerce with the rest of the planet.
Yeah, yeah. And you see, again, you can think of the golden cities in which mer people are said to live, or you can just think of dark, depressing depths. It's just proof positive again that there are no simple monsters. No matter how shallow you think a particular fictional or even mythological creature may be, when you start teasing it apart, there's a lot going on there. There's a whole legacy that it's built upon.
What's the name of the Cthulhu city, the city under the ocean where he hangs out?
I believe it's Rilye or something to that effect.
Yeah. I wonder how that compares to the Golden Palace of Triton.
I'm thinking it's maybe a little darker, a little less less well lit, a little less golden.
Totally random thought. Have you ever seen the coins that are the currency of Iceland?
No, do they have mermaids on them?
No, I haven't made it to the mermaid coins. Maybe at really high value they do. But the coins I remember there are great compared to our coins because our coins have like politicians on them. Mm-hmm. And their coins have all the children of Dagon. So they've got crab coins, they've got trout coins, like all of the sea creatures make it onto the currency.
That has to be better for teaching kids about money. Like my son would be far more into coins if they each had a cool animal on them. So take note, nations of the world. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to close out this episode, but there is going to be a follow-up episode in which we will discuss some of the science of aquatic humanoids. And if you don't think there's any science there, well, just tune in and you'll be surprised. In the meantime, check out all the previous episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find the podcast. You'll find blog posts. You'll find links out to our various social media accounts, such as Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram, you name it.
Big thanks, as always, to our audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. And if you want to get in touch with us directly to let us know what you think about this episode or any other, or to request future topics, or just to say hi or ask us a question, anything at all, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.